is 3:10. Apologize for the late start. House session. Clint Merck. Today's April 12th. With us today is Representative Moses, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Co-Chairman Schnell,
Vice Chairman Stoltz, Representative Hawkins here, Representative Wire, Representative myself,
Co-Chair Meyer. First thing we're going to take up today, we're going to take up two bills we've previously heard and had public testimony been closed on both of them. So now we're ready for any amendments or further discussion questions that the committee may have. So the first bill we'll take up is House Bill 130. That's the one we heard on Saturday pertaining to university land grants. So I guess first is we need a motion to get a working copy in front of us. Can I have a motion to adopt the House Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 130, version 24GH1034/X, Bullock, dated 4/12/05.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make that motion.
Okay. Any objections?
I'll object just to hear the changes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Very, very good. Actually, I don't think you need to object. You are okay with this version.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen it.
We'll have the changes explained to it. You should have it. Version X.
X.A.
Just X.
X?
X, yes. It's a finance version.
This would be the appropriate time for him to object.
Does everybody have the Representative Kelly, did you find the
I found my literature still.
Okay, if there's no objections to the having the finance version in front of us, then I'll ask Representative Wyrick to explain the difference in the changes that were made from the previous version. Representative Wyrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Really, the genesis of the committee substitute before the committee right now started at the very beginning, which is a very good place to start. But what happened is when the Natural Resources or the Resources Committee version came out, there was a committee substitute that was drafted, and that committee substitute was before the committee and the university and some other members of the public, and then this committee had a public hearing on the bill in general, House Bill 130, with some of the provisions that were testified on, particularly by the university, on the same date, and that was on, April 9th, we had public testimony. Subsequent to the public testimony that occurred on April 9th, I had talked with some folks in Southeast, but mostly had talked with the members of the university, Joe Beadle in particular, who does a lot of the lands work and is responsible for working on this, along with representatives from DNR, Department of Natural Resources. And what the result is, and I had worked directly with the legislative drafters, with Mr. Beadle and DNR folks on some of the changes that have resulted in this compromise version that's before House Finance today. And Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the Resource Committee version, because that's the most recent version that's been available to the public. On page 8, there was a section O, which had to do with native allotment applications related to Bjork Island and Lisianska Peninsula. And it was the university's request that section O be deleted. And instead, what has happened on the committee substitute before the committee, on page 4, the very top of the page, under section E, the native allotment language was added into that. So instead of identifying specific parcels at Bjork Island and Lisianska Peninsula, the lands conveyed subject to a valid possessory interest, which would include a native allotment land, is included under subsection E. So that's what happened. It took care of both the native allotment issue and it simplified the bill. And that's why that provision is out. Mr. Chairman, I hope that specific section is clear. The other thing that the bill did is, and what I'm looking at now is, again, the committee substitute.
That's the X version?
I beg your pardon, yes. The X version is before the committee now.
Yep. In the process. Representative Weirich, does anybody have the X version? And is there copies out for the audience? No. Okay, I see a lot of head shaking. Lula, do we have extra copies of this being made? Okay.
Do you want me to continue? Or do you want
yes, go ahead. Okay.
The other thing that had come out in testimony and also in reviewing some of the record for the introduction of the House Bill 130 in the first place, the University Lands Bill, was that there seemed to be some testimony related to a 250,000-acre group total that should go into the bill. And in light of that, and to keep track of that sort of sentiment, what the draft committee substitute did was identify specific parcels in subsections N and O on pages 5 and 6. Now, what those do is those simply pull out parcels that, based on information to the committee and through a lot of written testimony and emails, that individuals said were particularly important for development purposes in those local areas. Now, the committee has to realize that in adoption of this bill and potentially ultimately passing out, there's public policy calls we're making as a committee. On the one hand, we want to get land into private ownership and for development purposes, both to support the university's purposes and to promote what we believe is a policy is to promote private investment and increasing the tax base of the state of Alaska for private ownership to increase income to the state. And I think there's a general philosophic opinion that kind of a sentiment is good. On the other hand, that has to overlay against the concerns that we don't want quick development. We don't want development in areas where we haven't had adequate participation to involve ourselves in what could be or could not be in this bill. And we also want to ensure that communities that have lands adjacent to their communities can get those lands for borough formation. And so subsection N identified parcels that would be deleted from the university lands, while subsection O are deleted unless a borough forms. That is to provide a four-year window of opportunity for particularly Wrangell and Petersburg, which have indicated a desire to have these lands removed, so that they can form a borough, and that inclusion of these lands would interfere with borough formation. Now, there's still a request for additional lands to be excluded. There's no way that I think the committee should delude itself into thinking that lots of other ground hasn't been requested to be deleted from the university's land grant list dated 2005. But I think what we've tried to do in this bill, Mr. Chairman, is allow the university and I will point to the specific provision which allows deference to a municipality. Let me find it. Page 7, section C, subsection C, before the Board of Regents of the university offers a parcel for sale, the board shall offer first refusal to the closest municipality. And that seems to take care of the concern that, well, we have to have this for our borough formation, or this is very important to us. This requires the university and the municipality to engage in a conversation, and by the way, that includes a borough, to engage in a conversation and a potential give and take arm's length transaction to get those lands into the borough for their formation. So that should dispel that argument that this is going to really harm us as a locality. The second thing that it allows the Board of Regents to do is offer second refusal to a nonprofit organization that's established in this state of Alaska to develop the land for purposes that are consistent with historic uses. Now, what that means is there's a number of nonprofit organizations that may develop land, set up hatcheries, such as a private nonprofit hatchery, that may do camping educational purposes, that are nonprofit, that may develop land for housing if it's a nonprofit organization. That's an offer of second refusal to that type of organization. That's a discretionary offer. It should be noted that in the committee's letter of intent that the committee here does not intend for the university to convey this land to a nonprofit corporation or to an entity that intends to set aside the land and trust for conservation purposes or non-economically productive uses. And I tried to work very closely from the representatives from Fairbanks on this one, because what the testimony had come out with, Mr. Chairman, is that apparently the university had to provide land to the Nature Conservancy, which had set aside lands for those kind of purposes. And that seemed to fly in the face of the philosophic purposes for trying to get hands into private sector or private hands or at least development base and the tax base of the state. The other thing that the letter of intent does, which was not in any version of the original bill, was it indicates that land that is going to be conveyed at the cold foot node is not going to be used for businesses that would compete with an historic business there. And why that language is in the letter of intent and not in the bill of itself is because an individual had been given lease interest in DNR land along near the cold foot node property that's going to be transferred here. He was required under the DNR agreement to operate a 24/7, 365 day operation, and it's somewhat marginally economic. And if a competing business were to come into that area, it could have a serious and negative effect on his business, which he did knowing this land around him was completely open and it was not going to be open. So this is a completely new arrangement if it would be totally open to any kind of development that could potentially put him out of business that he did not know about when he entered into this long-term lease. And so there is that in the letter of intent. And it's my understanding, in working both with the Department of Natural Resources, the individual that owns that business, and the University of Alaska, that they are on all fours on working out some arrangement on that sort of provision. So, Mr. Chairman, that essentially are some of the most material portions of the bill that are before the committee today. Sections 1 and 2 of the committee substitute that came out of resources were deleted in their entirety, and most of that language, the salient portions of that language, were put into the committee's letter of intent, which includes both the non-conservation language that we talked about and this coal for node issue that we talked about. We thought it was more elegant to put it there than into the bill language itself. And I'm sorry to go on so long, but I wanted to try and get most of the provisions on the record.
Thank you, Representative Robert. No, you did a good job of explaining the changes. Does everybody have a copy of the letter of intent? That should also be in your package. And I think that verifies what Representative Weirich was saying about the cold foot note. Let's see, this is the... any questions about the CS for Representative Weirich? Or I think he was working with my staff on this, if there's any additional questions. Otherwise, since this is the governor's bill, I'd like to hear from the DNR if they've heard the changes, if they're in concurrence with it, if they have any questions. I show online that Dick Miles or Bob Loeffler. Maybe they're not. Oh, right. You're here to represent DNR? Because I don't hear him online.
Chairman, this is Dick Miles. I was on mute here.
Oh, okay, Dick. Go ahead. Have you been able to listen to the changes as described by Representative Weirich? I don't know if you have a copy of the finance version.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dick Miles. I'm the Deputy Director of the DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water. I did hear all the changes. I actually don't have the version X, but I have a version that I think is pretty close to that. Draft circulated apparently earlier. In general, we haven't really had a chance to digest everything, but I think we're generally satisfied with the changes.
Okay. Have you seen the letter of intent?
I have not seen the letter of intent, no.
Okay. Well, we'll fax a copy of the letter of intent to you so that you have that. Let's see. Okay. Any questions or anything for DNR?
Just a question of the sponsor, if I can. He went through that rapid fire. Just catching up with him.
Sure.
The changes, the shall may changes, can you do that one more time on page 7, line 5?
Under, you're referring to subsection C on page 7. The purpose of the language on that was twofold. Number one, the university is going to be transferred these lands from the Department of Natural Resources. When the university receives these lands, in order to dispense with them, they offer the right of first refusal to the closest municipality. And the second portion of that subsection is they may offer the second refusal to a nonprofit organization. Now, there's no requirement that they offer to a nonprofit organization, but the language here is stronger than in the bill than to indicate the legislature's desire that nonprofit organizations that are going to develop the land consistent with historic purposes are the kind of nonprofit that we want to look at, as opposed to the kind of nonprofit that is simply going to not put it in a kind of a tax roll. The closest municipality was indicated because what happened is around the city of Wrangell and Petersburg was the most common sort of testimony where this bill, the version X before us, does not have in it all the land Wrangell and Petersburg would like. In fact, the version that was before the House Finance on Saturday had roughly 10,000 more acres around Wrangell and Petersburg, and this deletes it in order to get it up to about 254,000 acres of land. So in deference to the Wrangell and Petersburg weren't getting all this property around it, at least it requires the university to offer these lands on first refusal to Wrangell and Petersburg, which are really in my mind here, because they were really the only communities that really testified under the Pelican. That if the DNR, if the university is going to sell these lands, they are required to do it first to the closest municipality. So at least that municipality can come together with its own resources, use its own tax-based revenues, put together its own sort of organization to buy this land for their own local purposes. And that's what's behind adding that language in this committee substitute.
So the old version said shall to both. We say shall for the first and may to the second.
The word shall to the first was in the version that was before the committee when we had testimony on April 9th. The word may was added to the request of the university. And that's another indication of how closely the university worked with us to get this bill to a point where I think they're satisfied with. So that's where that language came from, their suggestion.
Okay, maybe it would be appropriate this time to bring up the representative from the university. I know Representative Wyrick, you and Suzanne have worked with many parties on this. And
Mr. Beadle is the partner.
Okay, I'm trying to find a balance. Mr. Kelly, you represent the university as well.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Pete Kelly with the University Relations Office. Mr. Chairman, this seems consistent with the conversations between the university and the representative and DNR. There is one thing, however, on page 2 that the committee may want to take a look at, and that is under the board, the duties of the Board of Regents, that in number 10 it says ensure that the university shall... Yes.
Mr. Kelly, can't hear you.
Excuse me. It's microphone.
That's
here we go. It won't help, I'll just talk about it. All right.
Yeah, talk about it.
On page 2, number 10 under the duties of the Board of Regents to ensure that the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Service is adequately staffed to meet the needs of the public. Mr. Chairman, that's a bit of a departure from the rules for the Board of the Regents. Board of Regents, we don't think it necessarily fits the bill, and it also seems to be directing resources within the university's budget in a statute rather than an appropriations bill.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I can address that. What the bill before the committee on April 9th had as a duty of the university's Board of Regents to ensure that the Cooperative Extension Service is adequately staffed to meet the needs of the public. That was in the version before us on April 9th. In addition, what was before the committee on April 9th was a provision further back in the bill under the National Forest and that that the university shall hire any vacant position within the Cooperative Extension Service within 90 days of a vacancy. And in order to meet the university's needs again, that was taken out because of the concerns the university had that we were going to mandate hiring a specific position. So in deference to the university's testimony there, and I think again with Mr. Beadle, that was deleted from the bill that was before the committee on April 9th. The duty language under the Board of Regents to ensure that the Cooperative Extension Service is adequately staffed is somewhat a broader language, and that was again, as the unfortunate part of doing legislative drafting is that was sort of the compromise that was implicit in deleting one and leaving the other. There's no requirement there; it's just assurance language, because. The basis of this, the whole notion of this bill, a university lands bill, dealing with land, getting land into productive use, understanding what uses of the land are, and generating income and revenue to the University of Alaska, is integrated to the public support of the university and the public's desire for a strong, healthy university system. One of the best ways that the university has done that for the public that isn't faculty, staff, or student is to work through 4-H Cooperative Extension Services to understand how the land relates to them in their everyday life. And that's where the land version of this and the Cooperative Extension version of this meet and why that language is put in. That's the background. I can understand Mr. Kelly's testimony, but I also wanted the committee to be fully understand what went out of the version before the committee and why and what stayed in, because that went out. That was just sort of that's a legislative process. It's kind of ugly to watch. Okay,
Mr. Kelly. Mr. Chairman, thank you. As you look at the Board of Regents' duties, they're very broad duties, hiring a president, fixing the compensation for the president, giving the authority to enter into leases. It doesn't even get into the hiring of chancellors or directors or vice presidents. But then we add, by this version at the bottom, it says that the Board of Regents shall hire or shall ensure the specific staffing of a very low-level position. So it's directing appropriations, for one thing, which is something that the legislature will often check in pieces of legislation, but it is a far departure from the duties of the Board of Regents. As I said, it doesn't even, the normal duties of the Board of Regents doesn't even address whether they were higher chancellors or not, but then we're talking about a fairly low-level position here.
I should know, but what is the relationship between the Cooperative Extension and the management or use of these lands? Is it a university lands issue?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Well, yeah, I mean, on the university lands bill, I take it that the Cooperative Extension has some role in managing use development or of these lands, and I guess I don't know what that is. When I read through it, it's all about university lands except that, so I'm wondering what the Cooperative Extension's role in the management or why is it in the university lands bill?
Commissioner Wire, can you answer that?
Without repeating myself, I think I already did.
Yeah.
The lands, Cooperative Extension Service works with the lands connected with the people use the land.
Sometimes you talk too fast.
Yeah, I apologize for being slow to everyone. So it's not that they manage it or have direct, it's that they're a connection, if you will, or a conduit.
Mr. Kelly, I understand you heard the explanation. You still don't think that's a proper fit here?
No, Mr. Chairman, we don't. The lands bill, clearly that fits under the title. It's a very broad title. It doesn't seem to fit under the intention of the bill. This is a lands bill. And the other thing is that it's going to the duties of the Board of Regents. And I think there's a far distance between the general duties that the legislature has laid out and the very specific duties, even down to appropriations. You could make the case that you're forcing appropriations here in a bill that's dealing with land on a very low level position.
Okay. I disagree with you.
I do.
I appreciate the prophecies. Matt, it's unrelated to you. I'm just real short of faith in government entities and good faith today. So I just want to. It's one of the few things I like in the bill. So, what that's worth, probably not too darn much.
Let's leave it in the bill, and then if someone wants to make an amendment to take that out, we can discuss it at that time. Appreciate your comments. Everything else okay as far as the university is concerned?
As I said, Mr. Chairman, it seems consistent with the discussions that happened.
You're the recipient of this. I know you're not the bill sponsor, but DNR said that they were generally okay. All right, is there any amendments? I believe we have one. Amendment one by Representative Moses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move number one.
Any objections?
I want to object just to hear him talk a little bit.
I disappoint you, but I think Representative Sam has to speak to it.
Jeremiah Cherishinal, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Moira Smith, and I'm a legislative aide to Representative Salmon. And I understand that the members of the committee heard testimony from the McCarthy residents on Saturday, April 9th, regarding the inclusion of the McCarthy lands in the university lands bill. This amendment basically speaks to the section of the CS which removes certain parcels of land from inclusion in the university lands bill. And as you've heard overwhelmingly, the residents of McCarthy are opposed to inclusion of it. They say that the DNR has been a good neighbor. They've been able to get gravel and wood from DNR lands using DNR permits, and they would prefer not to see the university come in as an unknown neighbor at this time. I think that's enough. I'm happy to answer any questions if any committee members have any.
Okay. Any questions?
I guess I would have a question about it. That's what I was doing earlier, trying to get caught up with the public testimony that we had. Currently, what are the residents of McCarthy do behind you?
Primarily gravel and wood. A lot of the residents of McCarthy live in cabins and lead quasi or subsistence lifestyles, and so they apply for permits from DNR and get permits to go in and extract gravel and wood from the DNR lands. I believe that many of them do. I don't know the specifics of the private property ownership in McCarthy, but I think that the use of that state lands is useful to them in terms of resource extraction.
Thank you, Senator Schnell. So, if I understand your amendment, you want to delete parcel number PA.1001, Port Alexander?
No, I'm sorry. The amendment would add a new parcel to that list, number 10, which is the McCarthy Messina lands.
Gotcha. Okay. So you want to add that as? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Vilas, Invention DNR, have a comment? Anybody from DNR? Yeah. What about the university? On that. I know this is too appealing, but I'm having a little hard time. Anybody with DNR on the line?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
This is Dick Miley. I missed the question. Was it about the McCarthy, whether or not there's a reaction to that?
That's correct. That's the amendment.
Well, as you know, in our testimony, the university's testimony, one of the bottom lines with this bill is that we feel the bill has to come up with 250,000 acres of land to the university. The McCarthy tract is 12,500 acres, so that, along with the other parcels that were deleted in the proposed CS, would bring it down to about a little over 240,000 acres. So we'd oppose the deletion because we put of our goal there.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? For the record, Resident Holm and Resident Crofts have been here. I failed to recommend.
Do you maintain your objection? I just concerned about DNRs, so I guess I will.
Okay.
Go ahead, Resident Crofts.
Just to clarify that I think on the new version that should be page 6, line 10, page 6, line 11, and then it would add a tenth rather than an eighth parcel.
Yes, that's correct. That's why I was having a little trouble following this. You're absolutely right.
So when it passes, we know what it did.
Okay, Madam Clerk. Read the roll, please.
Representative Cross?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Crocker?
No.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Coyne?
No.
Representative Moses? Yes. Representative Stoll? No. Representative Weigrock? No. Representative Schnell? No. Representative Meyer? No. 3A, 7A.
Okay.
Amendment does not pass.
Okay.
Amendment 2, Representative
Crofts. I'll move Amendment Number 2.
Then moved and objected to, Representative Crofts, once it is.
Amendment number 2 is a change in concept for this bill. Let me say it this way. It's a major change in the bill, but it keeps, in my opinion, in line with the concept of the bill. To the extent that the bill says that there are certain state lands that have not been developed that should have for the last 20 or 25 years, for a long time, I agree with that. And to the extent we think that if we put it in the university's hands, we will get more aggressive development of those lands to the general benefit of the people of the state, I guess I agree with that too. But to me, when you talk about state lands that have not been developed to the detriment of the people of the state of Alaska, the biggest example of that is Point Thompson, where we've had state lands with significant oil and gas deposits under lease since 1978, and nothing has happened. We've gone through 20 plans of development. Over and over and over, we've had a failure of the leaseholders to develop or us to pursue it or some combination of it. And so amendment number 2 would give the university Point Thompson and say to the university and Mark Hamilton, we've been unsuccessful in getting this valuable resource developed since 1978. Why don't you take a crack at it? There's no better economic development potential that we could give. You can give them scattered cabin sites and various small to medium-sized parcels across the state, and you might get small logging or small sales, but you're not going to get any significant development that's going to put Alaskans to work through the university lands bill. This has the potential to do it. If we mean what we say, some state land has not been developed that should have, I submit that Point Thompson is the best example of that and will significantly affect the university's finances in a way that this bill will not. It doesn't have any of the associated concerns that we've seen and various people who have various interests in various parcels of land, because everybody, and almost, that's a completely true statement, everybody, the vast majority of people understand this ought to be developed. We've been trying to get it developed. If the university is going to be a more aggressive land manager, I say, great. Help us with the great sort of disappointment of our oil and gas lands, Point Thompson, and help us be more aggressive in developing it. The amount of money, if the university were able to do what we have so far been unable to do, is substantial, in the $225 million range a year. That happens to be approximately what the university needs in general funds from the state of Alaska. So, by a happy coincidence, you could get very close to having them do the development efforts that has so far eluded us, and have it there, a large majority of their general fund obligation being paid for that. You got the development, good on you, and you're reaping the benefits. Now, the numbers don't quite work out exactly cleanly, because under state, if the state developed it, of course, royalties would go into the permanent fund. We have a provision in this amendment that the university would continue that arrangement. And in addition, the bill says that 25% of the remainder goes into a trust fund. So after you take those two off, it's more like $137 million a year that would go to the university. You would be able to take something more than half of their operating budget offline. But I know it's an aggressive amendment, but the point of this bill is to be aggressive about the development of our lands. And if we mean that, I think we should take the major, substantial disappointment on real development, with real resources, with real money, and see if they can be more aggressive than we are.
Thank you for that explanation there, Representative Crofton. And you are totally changing the direction of this bill. You're putting the university now in the oil and gas business. Point Thompson, what is the state's share that you're giving up?
They would own the land, and they would have the resource. Now, they're a state entity.
Right.
You know, it's already a little odd that we're giving state land to a state entity. It's just transferring from one pocket, if you will, to the other. And we can't transfer state lands or subsurface rights to other people, but we can transform, just as we can the land, between the pockets of state government. So the university would have the duty and obligation to develop and would receive the profits from Point Thompson. They can put hotels on it, but I think the more productive use would be to drill for oil and gas.
But if I recall, isn't that Exxon's gas field, and we just have the state land that it's on?
No, we own it. And we've leased out to them.
To Exxon, yes.
And we like long-term lease, and like any other lease, you can say, your leaseholders in the building, by the way, I sold the building today, you'll be sending your payments to Mark Hamilton, care of the University of Alaska.
Interesting idea. But I just, you know, if it's something that we have been successful in getting any money off of, I hate to put the burden on the university. Representative Hall.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It just dawned on me that through the chairman to the maker of the amendment, do you know if it's possible that we could transfer the subsurface rights to the university from the state?
In what context? I'm sorry.
Well, in the context.
I don't think she's talking about
that. That's pretty good.
Go ahead, if you want to talk to whoever is on the line. Who is that?
Is that DNR? Somebody from DNR?
Who is speaking there?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dick Miley. It's from Department of Natural Resources. Did you want a response from DNR on that?
Well, let's hear Representative Holmes' question first.
Yeah, but I think DNR would probably be the right ones to respond. But can we transfer from the
state of Alaska's ownership of the subsurface rights of oil and gas to the University of Alaska. Could we do such a thing?
Representative Holm to the chair. This is Dick Milius again with DNR. The legislature could do that. The prohibition of transferring of the mineral or oil and gas estate is only restricting. It can't be transferred out of state ownership, but the university is an entity of the state, so legally I believe you could do that. But I'd like to clarify that doesn't mean DNR supports the idea.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd gladly support this if the representative from Anchorage had brought a permission slip from the governor and the Senate. But I'm afraid what this will do is just make sure that this bill goes over the bank, and that's what worries me. We haven't had our hearings regarding this sort of a slant, and as much as I'd like to see the university endowed with a gusher, I don't think that this is going to do something that I wouldn't like to see happen, and that is take a bill that's already been struggling for years to get out of this body and keep it here longer.
My view of the university and what I hope we can build in the university is something. We're such a rich state with so many vast resources, and we could endow the university with income-producing properties that it would be one of the both academically and fiscally wealthiest institutions in the nation, and it wouldn't have to come to the legislature anymore to grovel for its money. It would be well endowed enough to do all of the programs and all the research programs that it needs and wants forever. That is what I hope we would try and aspire to and at the university with. And a bill like this, with potential cash flow to it for this, could provide the seeds for that kind of a vision I think that the university would like, and I think a lot of legislators would like, so it wouldn't diminish the kind of revenues they have to siphon off to the university in favor of other programs, particularly K-12. So in another bill, in another time, in another way, in a broader context, I would like to pursue this on this. So I think this is a laudable sort of thing. Not that it would go to the permanent fund, but it would go to the university, maybe a permanent fund to endow it. But not in this bill.
I agree. And certainly do appreciate your creativity here, Representative Crock. I think it's just the wrong bill, wrong type. Any other comments?
Can I?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it sounded like that was heading the nice idea, but direction. I have passed out sheets, or believe I have, on what this would earn, so you can understand. This is from DNR's projections of what if Point Thompson were developed, the kind of revenues that would come from it. That if is the major point of this bill and this amendment. We haven't been able to do it. The precept of the bill, you said it's a major change in direction of the bill. I guess I'd equivalent say it's the same direction. It's different. It's a huge step up in the kind of parcels. But it's the same idea. You haven't been able to develop certain tracts of land. We should have. We hope the university will be more aggressive in getting it done. That's exactly what I mean. But I don't mean to take an accumulation of small campsites and other property. I mean the big thing that hasn't been done. If the university can get this developed, or we have not, not only will they get $137 million a year, but by the end of that period, there will be $1.2 billion in the trust fund. Nothing in this bill or any university lands bill has even come close to this, even in factors of 10. If you want to help the university and if you want to get development of this resource of Point Thompson, I submit to you that this is the way to do it. A couple of comments were made. The chairman said that this gets the university in the oil and gas business. My parents escaped from Texas way back in the 60s, and occasionally they'd send me back when I'd do something wrong, and I'd hang out in West Texas. The University of Texas went to its current place, because of the oil wealth it had. It made itself on oil wealth. could have stayed a very mediocre, sub-mediocre university and has got to its current position on the oil that was underneath the land it had. You talk about being a land grant, it's not that they got a bunch of campsites around West Texas. It wasn't that they cut trees on them. It's that they found oil under them, and that oil funded endowed chairs, positions, research, all the things you want a university to do. It was subsurface, not fighting municipalities over the neighboring view shed. This kind of thing is what made that university and many others, and can make ours, if we have the courage to stand up to it. One of the representatives said, I'm worried that this is a distraction for the Senate or might kill the bill. We did not change the title, the core title of the bill. So the core title would still be an act relating to the grant of certain state lands to the University of Alaska relating to the duties of Borden Region. The other body's free to put back in other parcels or this or any combination thereof. We did take out the university research forest because we changed the whole bill, but the grant of certain state land at the university would still be there. The concept would be there. They could put it back. They could put the whole bill back if they'd like. You know, this idea that it can be put in another bill, and it surely can, but why? If you think the university needs substantial amounts of money to do what we want to do, if you think development is important, if you think there are significant lands that have not been developed that should have, and if you think the university is going to be much more aggressive in getting it done, why not this? Why would we say, yes, we're going to very aggressively promote all these little parcels scattered around the state that sometimes have people who are affected by it and sometimes don't, but we're not going to aggressively develop this? This is a chance to do in the same direction of this bill the biggest land grant for the university that I've ever seen, and I think it would be one of the biggest land grants to come after establishment of a university system ever, to put our money where our mouth is. And I have been in favor of it as much because I want to break the logjam that has been Point Thompson, not have a 21st and a 22nd and a 23rd plan of development, as I am for the effect it has in the university. But I think it's a win-win. Thank you for letting me take so much time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Chairman. Yeah, on the amendment, and perhaps somebody here on the committee or on the it's my understanding there was a premise that this was a companion with an attempt to garner some federal land and some significant amount as well. And how would that impact that proposal? Is that would that be an expression of support of opposition to federal land grant?
It sounds like Representative Croft may have an answer.
Well, I've at least talked. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At least talked briefly to DNR about that, and that point was raised. There's this idea in bills that are proposed before Congress but not yet passed that if we come up with a certain amount, $250,000, that they would then match again, you know, the Fed would come in. And I don't believe that in acreage the Point Thompson land would qualify you under that proposed bill. However, if we put up Point Thompson, I think it would be, I mean, it could easily be amended, that bill hasn't passed, and well understood in Congress that we had put substantial skin in the game. They will understand, and we can understand, that $250,000 of land that has some marginal, sometimes decent development potential is us ponying up some, and that Point Thompson, even though it's less acreage, is putting up a lot more. So I don't think it would be any impediment to our argument before Congress to Senator Stevens and Senator Murkowski making the argument, the state of Alaska has done a significant amount, now you should. They say, they gave them, I don't know how much acreage in Point Thompson, less acreage, but much more value, and now we would like the federal government to step up as well.
So maybe the feds would give us Anwar, Point Thompson. Okay. All right. Any other thoughts on this? Questions, comments? Okay. Let's see. Representative Stokes, objection. Any objection?
Yeah, I guess we might have a vote on it.
Madam Clerk?
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Hopper?
No.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative
Kelly? Yeah, no.
Representative Moses?
Yes.
Representative Stokes?
Yeah, no.
Representative Weirach?
No.
Representative Kropp?
Yes.
Representative Meyer?
No.
Representative Schnell?
maybe it's not an option. Amendment 2 fails. Amendment 3, Representative Foster. Let me just do a little bit. Representative Foster wants to move the line 24, page 2, the discussion we had earlier. I know folks don't have a copy of it, but it was discussed earlier. On page 2, line 24, number 10, has to do with ensure that the University of Alaska's cooperative extension service is adequately staffed to meet the needs of the public. Is that your amendment, Representative Foster?
Do we move
to
lead it?
He wants to delete it, yes.
Page 2, line 10.
I'll object.
Okay. We'll have this discussion again. Representative, the reason why you felt that was important for the university property staff.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of the bill is to deal with land and resources in the state of Alaska and transfer those lands and resources to the University of Alaska. And the Board of Regents is in charge of governing the University of Alaska, and there's one of the closest connections between the University of Alaska's management of its lands and the cultivation of young minds is the support for the people in the state of Alaska. And most people in the state of Alaska who don't have any other connection to the university have it through 4-H clubs, through cooperative extension service, through offices which tell them how to and guide them how to till the soil, plant crops, raise things, how to husband animals, how to do all kinds of things. This is not requiring the University of Alaska to go out, the board to go out there and interview people or anything, but just to ensure that extension service is staffed to meet the needs of the public that are so supportive of this university. That's why it's in there.
Okay, thank you, Representative Weirach. President Stokes?
I can't let the guy from Juneau know ag to here. I'd like to just give the university a reminder that there's agricultural roots to this university, and they seem to forget that too often. And this is a real subtle way of
subtle.
I guess that is a sarcasm.
Okay. Again, amendment would be to delete number 10, lines 24 and 25 on page 2. The objections. Thank you. Okay. Let me just think here. Okay, Madam Clerk.
Representative Hopper?
No.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Moses?
No.
Representative Stokes?
No.
Representative Weirach?
No.
Representative Kropp?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Schnell?
Yes.
Representative Meyer?
Yes.
5-5.
Okay, we have 10. So passed.
So failed.
Okay. All right. And 3 failed to delete that section, so that will stay in the bill. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Lauer.
I should note that we've received lots of potential amendments. Tom's place by Wrangell. I talked to Representative Wilson about deleting that. I think it opens up a huge can of worms. I'd like to leave that another day, and I don't see votes for that. Although I want to support Tom's place and those who have withdrawn, I just think we'll save the committee time. I didn't want Representative Wilson to know that it wasn't a concern of mine.
Okay. Very good, Representative Warwick. I appreciate that. Obviously, this bill will still has ways to go. So as you, as members read through it, if you see other areas of concern or hear from the public areas of concern, there's still other opportunities yet.
Okay, Kristen Foster.
Okay, I'll go ahead and move out of committee. 8230. Add amendments to the tax system office.
Letter of intent. Any objections? See none, the bill passes committee. No.
still have a few more bills to do yet. Sponsor, if you could join us, Representative Ramos, and trusty staff, if she wants to join us. James Kirsten, right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I brought extra help.
Good.
Sir.
All right. I need it. Okay, and then for the record,
Mr. Chairman, this is Stephanie Birch.
Stephanie Birch, okay, good. Okay, we had public hearing on this bill, and we closed the public hearing. I think we were at it. I had a question on the fiscal note, actually. I understand, Stephanie, you're going to answer the bill's questions for us.
Yes, sir, thank you.
Okay, sir, very good. My concern is with the HESS. Starting with the year 2008, and if I read the backup here correctly, it looks like we're going to hire a person in the year 2008 to 2009. And we don't show, we're not showing any positions being filled. And so I was questioning that. And then if you could just walk through the numbers for 2008 on and how this approach should work out with 17.
Thank you, Chair Meyer. For the record, I'm Stephanie Birch. I'm the section chief for the Women's, Children's, and Family Health section for the division of both public health and healthcare services. The finance part of this, the funding changes somewhat in fiscal year 2008. We have been successful in the last 4 years and now for the next 3 years in successfully being awarded two grants from the federal government, one from HRSA and one from CDC. The second federal grant would be scheduled to expire, assuming that there won't be renewed funding, three-quarters of the way through fiscal year 2008. The half-time positions that are funded, that would be funded after that period of time, utilizing state general fund money, are actually being funded at the present time using federal money. And those positions then would be there as partial support to this program. The program manager specifically also runs the newborn metabolic screening program, which you probably are aware of the fact that that's a state-mandated program as well, where we track all newborns. So the work is very similar, and it makes sense to share the responsibility of tracking newborns for two entities, basically. So we're trying to be efficient in terms of sharing responsibilities for two different programs with one person. So I think that answers your question, Chairman Meyer. Thank you.
Okay. I think it does too. So on the second page that's attached here, you have again travel costs, flight costs, and flexible costs, and those are all shown in the fiscal fund section.
That's correct, Chairman Meyer.
And they're shown, I guess I just see them.
They would be shown, Chairman Meyer, in the general fund dollars starting in FY08 of 77.1 thousand, 167.4 thousand, 180.5 thousand. The other monies that are part of that general fund, the larger portion of those are actually dollars that we're requesting as part of this fiscal note to pay for the early intervention hearing resources program. So it's primarily treatment that we would be offering. At the current time, the early intervention program, which is funded, as you know, out of Part C money and some general fund money, has a newborn hearing services program for these kids. They need intensive hearing service support. And as we identify more children, we anticipate we would need additional dollars for them. However, we've accounted for only a slight increase on an annual basis.
Okay, and then the half person, or whatever person is being paid for now with federal funds, would be picked up with general funds in 2008?
That's correct, Chairman Meyer.
All right. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we spent some time on this already. The what this money is being used for. Is this where will it primarily be paid? Is it the physicians that perform this? Is it the people that work in the field that would perform these tests? I only know anecdotally what my Lions Club has done on vision screening, and we supply supplies, and we usually get a volunteer health care professional. I just need to have a better understanding of the leverage on this.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, the program actually has. The newborn hearing screening program has actually been in effect in several hospitals since 1998. At the present time, all 23 communities where births are taking place have newborn hearing screening equipment in the hospital or in the community. We have a couple of small communities where the birth rate is so small that it wouldn't make a lot of sense for that community to spend the money to buy hearing screeners. So we actually, through our federal program, have purchased screeners for 9 additional communities where the birth rates are small or where we know, in fact, that we have a high number of out-hospital births. The hospitals then have incorporated the costs of doing the screening, which ranges from anywhere from $20 to $40 in their hospital rate already. So there's no dollars that are actually being paid to providers. It's part of the normal hospital care that you would find or normal birthing center care that's being found. And what the state has done through our federal grants is to provide equipment and training, all of the education resources, videotapes, and then public education and media kinds of things. Thank you.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Limiting discussion to this one, I'm still confused with your numbers and figuring out your grant for full coverage. Just let us say I'm adequately confused. However, I do have some concern. I think it should concern members of this committee that do walk the fine line between balancing government intervention in the lives of citizens and providing for the public health, public welfare, for constitution and condition. On the notes to the fiscal note, in that first paragraph, your second sentence, and I want to preface this with, providing these hearing cert and hearing testing is clearly an appropriate and proper thing to do to make it how we get there.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a real problem with the language chosen here, which is going to be a matter of public record that says, that seventh sentence, the program requires a reporting and surveillance system for tracking all newborns. And there's something that troubles me about saying that we are putting in place a surveillance system for tracking all children born in the state of Alaska. And I go to the very bottom line as well. Under that, on the bottom paragraph, there are contractual expenditures. The 27,700 at YOA includes the actual cost of supporting web-based data and surveillance system. And again, it's a choice of word, but it's a little bit troublesome. I'm not so sure I want that. I think the public, remember our Constitution also provides a right to privacy. It's a very important component. And so just a little word for your choice of language here. And, I'm just wondering if you would object to my request to revise this note and let's not be creating a Big Brother eye in the sky surveillance system.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I share your concerns about personal privacy issues, and as I understand it as a layperson, is that what we're really doing is rather than tracking individuals, we're trying to do some statistical tracking of how many newborns and that is it the portability? Is it HIPAA, I believe, it allows for the portability of medical information, but also maintains the privacy, except as the benefit extends to the state for being able statistically to track precisely how many congenital birth defects we have in this category, which right now is a very loose statistic for the state, and it will better help the state understand this problem and be able to frame it going forward. So I agree with your concern over some of the semantics, and I'm very comfortable addressing that, but I assure you that the intent behind it is not to surveil or to come up with a list of people that are going to be followed through their adolescence, you know, as you know, as a child that has a you know, sticker behind their name. And I'll defer to Stephanie, but I think my understanding of it is correct, and I'll defer to you, Stephanie.
Yes, thank you, Representative Hawker, through the chair. Generally, the word surveillance is used as a public health term. It's one of the core functions of public health, and so I think sometimes we don't think about how it may always be perceived by the public, and I think your comments are well spoken. The intention, really, from a surveillance standpoint is, in fact, to do what Representative Ramros has suggested and really get a sense of how big the problem is. By having a methodology of observing these children over a period of time, we know that we have a large portion of children who will develop late onset hearing loss due to some of the circumstances surrounding their birth, either through their stay in the newborn intensive care unit, family genetics, which we have a plethora of unusual genetic birth defects here in the state, as well as just circumstances perhaps of infections that they might have been exposed to during their time prior to delivery. And so we really want to be able to observe those kids and make sure that we get them into services as early as possible, especially prior to their school age time. So surveillance has the best of intentions, although I can certainly understand you know, your concern. Thank you.
Sure, go ahead. And I appreciate your willingness to work with us on that one. There's going to be another provision in the bill, we have to discuss in the bill, that I think would solve a lot of my problems. To the fiscal note, your last sentence there has a conditional language. The department is proposing elimination of section 47.20.310G. It is not possible on short notice to determine the increased cost department included in G, and therefore this fiscal note assumes that subsection G is deleted. Has that been deleted from the bill, or is that the subsection G that is still in place for us?
It has, in fact, Representative Hawker through the chair. If you, well, I have, you have the Labor and Commerce
yes.
version. If you look on page 5.
Yes, ma'am. Lines 20 and 22
mm-hmm.
on line 5 would be the current subsection.
Right. There was wording in the original bill that was introduced discussing how the department would track any newborns who perhaps might have been born without any means of financial support. And I think the it was lines 15 through 19, actually, under the original original bill, and my rationale was that the payment methodologies for screening, both during a hospital stay and for follow-up screening, have been established with the recent revision of Medicaid regulations and the accompanying provider billing manuals. It's not feasible for the department to take on the costs and reimbursement processes that would need to be established in order to reimburse the hospitals for non-paying patients. Does that help?
The short answer is that the subsection G provisions that we're referencing in your fiscal note have been eliminated from the bill.
That's correct.
And so, Mr. Chairman, from respect, I would also ask that we inform the fiscal note to recognize that G, that this G as it sits here is not intended to be changed.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I think there's a little more work that can be done in the fiscal note. We're not going to hold the bill up just for that, but. Because I really would like to see the fiscal note broken down a little bit more, like in year 2008, as we talked about, and show what the contractual costs are, supply costs.
So, Chair Meyer, are you asking for a more detailed budget outline for each of the fiscal years starting with FY08?
Starting with 2008. Yes.
Okay.
The reps in the home.
Do you have questions? I didn't hear you.
Representative Holder.
Thanks. That was just a joke. Representative Ramos through the chair. In our discussions earlier about this bill, one of my comments to you or my question to you was to find out if, in fact, it would be some savings at some point in time if, in fact, we assume that we're having extra costs today because we're not recognizing the hearing problems. And it was my understanding from you that you thought that there would be downstream some savings because we would have less people suffering from these types of illnesses or problems that were we would intervene beforehand. So obviously we would be able to save some money downstream from having some expenses through our medical payments for these particular illnesses. I don't see any of that recognized in your fiscal notes. I was wondering if there's some way we could somehow reflect it, that we won't be just continuing down this road of another increase in general fund matches, that somehow this might be mitigated by some additional saving someplace. Any comments to that?
Through the chair, Representative Holm, I'm so new here. And I wish I could give it a more imaginative spin because I appreciate your point of view and I unless either of these ladies can present a rationale to do that, I don't know quite how to capture that. But your remarks are absolutely correct. One is that if we catch this early, we can mitigate some hearing loss and recognition through cochlear implants and through other mitigating factors to diminish the severity of the hearing loss, and also to enhance the cognitive development of these young people at an earlier age, because by the time that they hit school age, they become the problem of the state of Alaska through one mechanism or another. So the earlier that we capture this problem, the more that we're able to mitigate the cost. But I don't really have a mechanism. I'll defer to Stephanie or to Jane if they think they can figure out a way to frame the savings to the state. But there is, at some point, there should be a positive fiscal note recognized by the state of Alaska for these savings. But it's beyond me in my early development as an effective legislator to figure out the means by which to do that. So I'll defer to Jane or to Stephanie on that point.
Through the chair, Representative Holm. One, it hasn't necessarily been reflected in the fiscal note because we only recently did this, but I did look at all of our Medicaid claims for children who have received treatment. So these would be diagnostic and treatment services in FY03 and FY04. We had a total of 946 recipients, and the average cost that where Medicaid claims were $582 per recipient. That compares with about $760 per recipient in FY02. So I think, and that was a preliminary review. We haven't gone back to do chart reviews and validated all of the claims in CODI, but I think it gives us a preliminary review that if caught earlier, the treatment dollars required for these children that normally are paid out of Medicaid, which of course there's a state fund match, will decrease. I think the second part of what Representative Ramros was suggesting is that the school costs, which we know children who require special education run an average of over $12,000 per year versus an average cost of around $4,000 to $5,000 per year. And so although we haven't tracked these kids because the program is early and some of these kids haven't even reached school age yet, I'm hoping that we'll see fewer of these kids in special ed programs because they're able to be mainstream. In fact, I think some of the testimony from some of the parents whose children are starting to get to school has demonstrated that for you.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, that just as a follow-up, I would, as Representative Hocker said, I'd like to see maybe some of that reflected in the somehow here in this fiscal note. I'd like to see something that shows that we are going to receive this, if it truly has gone down just in 3 years to a for that large of an amount. I think it wouldn't be that hard to make use of extrapolation that might make this look a little bit nicer from a fiscal standpoint. So I could request that, I'd appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Holm, that is something that we will work on as we as this bill continues on its way, particularly through the other body. But I thank you. I thank you for that recommendation, and from Representative Hawker as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, normally we don't like to pass off work to the committee, but it's just physical evidence.
Well, there's some folks in the public defender's office who can probably help you out. They can make some anecdotal claims and just say it's indeterminate, and then we're set.
Any questions on the bill itself? Did you have a question?
Actually, I did, sir.
Okay. Without me, a question here.
Page 5, lines 12 through 8, 12 through 19. This is the only sort of opt-out provision that parents have. And it basically says that if someone who's, the physician doesn't have to do this, if the parent objects on the grounds, and I'm quoting here now from lines 14 and 15, on the grounds that the procedure conflicts with the religious tenets and practice of the parent. Absolutely appropriate, but again, on a philosophic basis, the freedom of religion also includes the freedom from religion. And I'm a little concerned here that we are denying the right to, for a parent to object on a grounds other than religion. And I think you're not answering, you very clearly see my point. Mm-hmm. We are precluding an entire cohort in our society that may not be religious, but may have a more ethical objection to participating in treatment. I just wonder if you could give me a broad set.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, there's no disagreement here to modify that, and Stephanie was just sharing with me that it's we simply lifted the language from
the regulations around newborn metabolic screening.
Around newborns, the regulations for newborn metabolic screening. So we certainly can amend that language, or you're welcome to offer a conceptual amendment that accommodates that. In fact, you may just be able to delete the word religious. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we appreciate it a lot.
All right, now we're going to do a double header here with Representative McGuire. Representative McGuire, do you have a preference on which bill to take up first?
225. Why don't we go with that, since that's what I have in my hand.
225.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, I'm going to be very brief. I know the committee has had a long day and is under time constraint, and then I'll just take questions. Last year, Alaska had over 1,100 cases filed in the state of Alaska. We have only one state coroner that fulfills all of those responsibilities, which include obviously the technical part, the medical part of examining the bodies, the autopsy, along with testifying in court. If it's a suspicious cause of death, it's required that the coroner be present to testify to the facts in his autopsy report, and then also all of the administrative duties. I am not one that is normally advocating for more government positions, Mr. Chairman, but in this particular instance, this is a detriment to all of Alaska by having just one individual housed in Anchorage. Frankly, if that individual is sick or has to leave for a family absence for any number of reasons, we don't have anybody in the entire state of Alaska available to do autopsies. And why this is serious, Mr. Chairman, it's not for the elective autopsies where a family just may want to put their mind to rest. It's for things that include communicable diseases. For example, if you had an outbreak of an Ebola virus, or if you had an outbreak of bird influenza or something, you'd want to know about that immediately to contain the problem and prevent future health spread. Without somebody in that position to do it, the entire state of Alaska is at risk. And then finally, in cases of suspicious death, places where there is a potential murder on our hands, certainly it's in all of our interest to know the information to that quickly. The House wisely has included in its operating budget this position, and so really this is just the statute that catches up to the money. That's why you see a 0% note, Mr. Chairman, and it's my hope that the members of this committee would support this bill today.
Okay. We'd like 0% notes. Any other questions for the sponsor? We do have a couple of people online to testify to, so maybe we can't find answering questions as people are pondering. Let's see, Mike Arturier. Probably saying that wrong, with the Anchorage Police Department. Or Dr. Don Rogers.
Yes, sir. This is Sergeant Couturier. Hello, hello.
Oh, yes. You said it's Dr.
Yeah, this is Dr. Don Rogers in Anchorage.
Okay. Let's see. Let's start with Mike Couturier.
Hello, this is Sergeant Mike Couturier with the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Great. And I just got through, so I'm not sure if I'm on House Bill 210 or House Bill 225.
225.
You pick. No, House Bill 225.
I picked before. It didn't work well.
Okay.
Hi, thanks for hearing me today. On House Bill 225, which I think through all that, that's what we're on, right?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm the vice president of the police officer union here, and we wanted to provide some testimony, some input, and maybe even answer some of your questions concerning the need for and our support for a deputy medical examiner. There was a time back in our past, if I'm remembering correctly, where Dr. Probst and Valico worked together, and now we're now at the Valico with Dr. Valico. Probst retired or whatever happened with him, I'm not sure. But there are calls that we go to on the street that somehow are in the gray area between needing an autopsy or not needing an autopsy, and that's where our emphasis and sometimes our concern arises. We definitely support the deputy position and the change that's been suggested here by Representative McGuire. Some things for you to think about when we request are needing autopsies for serious traffic accidents. It's not a homicide. It's not a very serious assault that turns in then results in death. Another one would be suicides. Is it a suicide or isn't it a suicide? We show up at a scene. We do an assessment. We look for some evidence. The person has died, but exactly why? Sometimes the means are there. Right in front of us, but we need some supporting evidence. Well, and also with infant deaths, with suffocations of infant deaths, rolling over under pillows, those kinds of things, been on those calls, and SIDS cases. And that's where the margin is for us as we operate as first responders for the city of Anchorage and your other first responders for the state. And that's where that call goes out to the medical examiner on, hey, here's what we have. Here's as much history as we can collect in the last, 30 minutes at this call. And, hey, what do you think? Does this person need an autopsy or don't they? Here's what's suspicious. Here's what we don't believe is suspicious. Here's what the person looks like. Those kinds of pieces of information are passed typically telephonically. And then the good doctor or someone else there, you know, either collects more data or makes a determination. And then, of course, place yourself in the position, of course, of the doctor who's working alone here, who has 1,100 cases and knows what the caseload and his calendar is coming up. And we all, obviously all hope that he's making the best decisions, and I'm sure in his mind he is absolutely making the best decisions, but we can allow him to make better decisions, I think, if he just needs an assistant. There's just really no way, I think, that anyone could argue differently. And we would hope that you would support House Bill 225.
All right. Thank you for that testimony.
You're welcome.
Sergeant? Okay, let's go on to Dr. Rogers. I know you're online. We've heard part of you earlier.
Now, I was a state medical examiner for 27 years. I started in 1967. And until about 1953 or so, we did essentially all of the, quotes, coroner's cases, unquotes, in the state. That is, everybody who died unattended or who died of homicide, suicide, accident, on the job, or whatever. We did them all, but we had a little different procedure for doing them than you do now. We did a more brief but thorough enough for the purpose autopsy, but we did them all, that's the point. And when the function was shifted from the court system to health and social services, we were instructed to do fewer because we were doing more than the average around the country. What we were doing was a better job than the average around the country, we thought, and the death certificate statistics would support that. Our death certificate statistics were among the best in the country back then, and now they're average. And the point being that until you do an autopsy, you really don't know whether you need one or not. And we catch a lot of things are not always what they seem. You know, as the police officer just said, sometimes it looks like a suicide, but it may not be. And until you look at the body, you really can't tell. So they're making guesses now as to what people die of. I've been doing about 25 autopsies a year, and most of them are people who die suddenly and unexpectedly, and the family does not accept the guess that the medical examiner makes. I don't mean this as a criticism of Dr. Falico at all. He's doing the best he can with the time he has available. But he needs help, and this bill would be a start. In order to solve the problem, that, as I see it at least, it's going to take a change in policy from HSS, or rather, there's going to have to be some encouragement to do more autopsies than they're doing now. So I'm glad the bill is up, and I hope you all will support it.
Great, thank you, and thank you for staying with us. We do have a question for you, Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Rogers. I sincerely appreciate you coming forward with this. You know, we've been trying for 2 years to get the money in the budget for an additional position, and I just want to sincerely thank you for the initiative to guide folks like myself, Rep. McGuire, the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, amongst others, and how critical this is. I really appreciate that. And I'd just like to add to the comment that Representative McGuire made earlier that the House did put the $100,000 funding for an additional medical examiner position in the budget. That provision didn't survive the Senate. We're going to need all the help we can get from you to get it back in the budget in the end, sir. But thanks again for your time.
Okay. I didn't hear a question there for me, but one I will sign off.
It was more in the line of compliments, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's a good point. Richard Hawker has mentioned on the fiscal note, it doesn't show that it's in the 2006 budget, even though we have it in the 2006 budget, and it's now been removed. I guess for the record, we just need to say that it's our intention to fund this, and we did have it in the 2006 budget, and we wanted to say that we'll have to sell that, I guess, in the conference committee. Representative Phillips?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was the legal matter procedure. Something that you I guess I'd follow up on this. This started out as a conversation that I was one of many people you probably talked to. It's good when a good idea gets this far, so good work.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, Representative Snow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would have one comment. While it may be justifiable and while it may be currently needed, just philosophically have a problem with in the fiscal note that we say we're going to mandate the commissioner to do this, realizing that they do need it. But I concern myself when we start mandating that we shall, that there's no way to come back from that. So just a comment more than anything else, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, good point, Representative Snow. Yeah, we might want to modify the fiscal note here a little bit. Again, just put a check mark in the box where it says that it's in the budget, and then tone down the mandate a little bit. Yes,
if I may, on that exact point,
okay.
And again, I ask Representative McGuire to correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe that the bill that's before us requires that any additional personnel be hired, but it specifically says that it's the we appoint a state medical examiner, and we also appoint a deputy, which could obviously come from our existing personnel base without hiring someone else. In our budget, which the House wisely passed, we have said the department needs additional personnel, although even in our budget, it does not say that additional personnel shall be the deputy medical examiner. It's the additional resources to let the commissioner and the department, you know, operate in its fullest efficiency.
Okay. Representative Clark.
Thank you. And on that point, that's exactly right. If the department wanted to pull somebody from within the ranks to make them the deputy medical examiner, that would work as well. So Representative Hawker is exactly right. But what we try to do in looking at the existing statute, not wanting to reinvent the wheel and not wanting to micromanage too much, was to simply say it's like we want a president and a vice president. We want somebody to be there in case something should happen to the president. And then beyond that, we chose not to micromanage at all and included and may appoint assistant medical examiners. So beyond that point, should the commissioner do, I think, what his intent is, which is to add even more, and to really try to go back in and beef up this particular department, this office of the medical examiner, then that could certainly be done. We didn't want to get into those details, but so those are my points.
Okay. Forget Christian Hoff?
No, that's it, sir. I think it might be proof. What I offer to the co-chairs is I think this one has written suits the situation already.
Right.
I'm convinced from the debate or information that we probably should do this, but the second time today that we've reached out, and I guess I'm echoing what Representative or Co-Chair Chenault said, that is we're supposed to be careful what we're in this area, because and we've done it twice today. We've reached out and said we can do, the university has total flexibility on the Board of Regents, but no matter how much you cut their budget, they've got a fully staffed, not just fully staff the Cooperative Extension Service, and here we're saying you will manage this by having a deputy commissioner. So it plunges down into an area that we've got to be careful about, but I think you made a good case that probably how to do this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Amendments? Concerns? President Hawthorne?
I'm going to have to go ahead and be back on the committee.
objections? Seeing that, Bill, is that okay?
Yeah, I think 210, some of the same people are online to testify for your next bill, Representative McGuire. But why don't you go ahead and introduce the bill and explain what it is?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This will be familiar language to you and most of the members of the House Finance Committee. The policy, the due process, everything that's built into this was thoroughly looked over in years past when we set up the bloodborne pathogen testing program for corrections officers. And the Judiciary Committee in particular put in some real sideboards if the person didn't want to give, for example, a sample of blood or of saliva or so on. And so all of those protections, all of the well thought out and crafted policy exists in the bill. The only difference that we're making now is we're adding adult and juvenile offenders among the list of those folks who might be putting people in contact with bloodborne pathogens. And then in addition to a correctional officer, in place of correctional, we're expanding it to public safety officers. So it will continue to include correctional officers, but it will also include firefighters, peace officers, emergency medical technicians, and mobile paramedics. And Mr. Chairman, you and I don't have to worry about this. Fortunately, most members of this committee have never had to, but being exposed to another individual's blood or bodily fluid can be a very frightening experience in this day and age with all of the hepatitis and HIV and viruses that are out there that impact you for life. It's a virus, and there's nothing you can do about it once you have it other than manage it. So what we're trying to do is at least give these public safety officers the ability to have some comfort and for their families to have some comfort if they feel they have been exposed, to be able to have these tests to know whether or not that person is in fact infected with some type of a virus. And I'd be happy to answer questions, but the bill really walks through the process by which someone has to go through. And I would in particular just draw members' attention to page 4, section 3. So page 4, starting on line 5, that's the area that I have gotten. There has been widespread support for the bill, but if there have been any questions, it's what happens if they won't consent? What if they just say, I'm already going to jail anyway. I don't really care. I'm not going to test. This is the process, and it is very, very well thought out. It requires a petition to the Superior Court, and the petition has to allege certain things. It requires a 48-hour notice to the person who would be tested themselves, and even a statement by a licensed physician that, in fact, that there is probable cause to believe that this individual may have exposed a peace officer to a bloodborne pathogen. So I just wanted to do that. And then one other question somebody had at one point was, what is the definition of a juvenile offender? And that can be found in Title 47, 4712.020. A delinquent minor is somebody who is under the age of 18 and who is alleged to be or may be determined by a court to be a delinquent minor as a result of violating criminal law of the state or of the municipality. Those are the only questions I ever received. So.
You took both my questions.
It's probably already covered, but is there any ambiguity between a juvenile that's been adjudicated as an adult offender or not?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, no. No, not at all, because a delinquent minor includes those in the auto waiver under Section 100, so it's more inclusive then.
Okay. We do have a couple people to testify. Let's see. We have, again, Officer Mike Couturier, and then Will Atchison, attorney for the Anchorage Police Department. And for questions is Tony Heumann, Division of Juvenile Justice. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and go to, if anybody's online for the next bill, House Bill 54, we will not get to that today. So we'll take that up first thing tomorrow. It's Representative Samuels' bill. With that, and then I am going to do a radio talk show at 5 o'clock, so the vice chair will take over.
So with that, I will go to
Need to scout up another member.
Oh, it looks like
Mike's here.
Mr. Okay, so we only have one online to testify now. If you go long enough,
you're still upstairs.
Fall off. Okay. Yeah, Officer Mike Couture, are you still there, sir?
Yes, I am. Oh. And my name is Sergeant Mike Couture, and I wanted to just clarify who's working for who. This is the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Aitchison is our legal representation for our Anchorage Police Department Employees Association. He is not an employee of the APD. Just wanted to clear those up. My testimony today, Mr. Chair, is to thank Representative McGuire for the introduction of House Bill 210. It's long overdue. The Anchorage Police Department Employees Association fully supports and applauds her initiative on this. House Bill 210 will help provide appropriate protection for police officers accidentally or intentionally exposed to infectious pathogens by exposure to blood to body fluids. The bill provides a mechanism to test both the police officer and the person who exposed the officer. House Bill 210 follows the examples set in other states which allow such testing, and not only will provide safety and peace of mind to peace officers and their families, but also provide ample privacy protections for criminal suspects. The bill will enable the police officer to know if the exposure to such pathogens did occur so that the officer can begin appropriate medical steps. And I'm one of those officers, and I didn't have those protections, and I would appreciate your support individually and the members of our union, which are first responders, will also appreciate your support on this. And I'm open to any questions you might have.
And thank you. Is there any questions? Seeing none, I believe that's all we have to testify for public, so I'll bring the bill back before the committee. Representative McGuire, I did have one question that came up. What about probation officers?
Probation officers are, Mr. Chair, probation officers are under the definition of peace officer.
Yes. Through Mr. Chairman, on page 7, lines 4 through 8, which would be subsection 8 there, it defines a public safety officer. And among those definitions is a probation officer or even a parole officer.
Okay, what was the question that was raised? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for my information, Representative McGuire through the chair. God forbid, what would happen if a police officer refused to get tested? Say he chose he didn't, or a public safety officer chose not to be tested when they were exposed for whatever reason. Do we have a requirement that requires that our employees are tested? I mean, so I guess what I'm hypothesizing here is it puts at risk then those others that work with him if in fact he or she does contract the disease under those conditions.
Through the chair, Representative Holm, that's a good point, and I'll let Officer Couture comment on it, but from the perspective of the peace officer, it's voluntary. It's when they make the request. I came at this bill from the standpoint of them saying, we want a tool. We've all wanted this to be able to occur and to have that peace of mind and weren't able to. I don't know, and maybe Officer Couture could describe if it's ever happened that somebody's been exposed and decided they didn't want to or refused to. Did you hear?
Am I muted right now?
No, you're speaking.
No, you're live.
Okay, great, thanks. It's just hard to tell at this end. I apologize.
We won't mute you on this end. You will mute yourself on that end.
Somehow or another, they mute and unmute me from over there. But in any case, Mr. Chair, to whoever asked the question, I'm sorry.
Representative Holm,
your scenario is an interesting one. Our policies and procedures for actions to be taken during a suspected exposure to bodily fluids is to be tested. If I might take a couple of minutes, that's more complicated than what it sounds. Because, for instance, if you're testing for HIV, it has to go out of state and come back, which is a minimum 72-hour turnaround from draw, because it has to be flown out. It might end up a little less time as a result of a phone call from Washington, Washington State, but that's at best. More directly to your question, I'm having a hard time imagining a police officer or a peace officer, period, not refusing to get tested, unless, of course, hypothesizing maybe they already knew they had a HIV or Hep A, B, C, something like that, and they don't want, for instance, the department to know about it. That's about the only way I could see this happening. So their family already is aware that the peace officer has this communicable disease, this virus, whatever. So he or she doesn't need to be tested. That's the only way I can imagine that happening. So in that case, they're already around the other employees anyhow. I don't think this particular bill addresses your issue, nor was it its intent. But of course, Representative McGuire can address that. This is a handle that helps, from my perspective anyhow, risk management at hospitals. That's really the tie-up. It gives risk management something to lean on at regional and Providence and hospitals around the state to say, okay, there's a court order here, here's legislation backing it up, we can afford to now do these tests and not have to deal with being sued, etc. And that's the tool they need.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might follow up for just a second, I'll go about 3 seconds longer.
Real fast.
I didn't mean to throw a monkey wrench into this outfit. I just wanted my good friend, the representative who is the chair of the Judiciary Committee, not to miss me so much. She taught me well. Thank you,
Representative Holm. Is there any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Foster.
Yes, sir, I'll go ahead and move out AC210 out of committee with Liberal Education. Thank you.
There's no objections. We will move House Bill 210 out of committee.
Thank you very
much. That's the end of finance for today. Before you leave, sign the sheet. Tomorrow, Wednesday the 13th at 1:30, we will take up House Bill 54, which is bail review. We will take up House Bill 182, Wage and Hour Act, HB 169, Real Estate Licensee, HB 98, Non-Union Public Employee Salary and Benefit, and also HB 27, which is the Municipal Property Tax Exemption for Police Homes. Also, under bills previously heard or scheduled, we will take up House Bill 32, which is appropriations for Arctic Power for ANWR. So with that, if there's no other business to come before the committee, we will adjourn for the day. Thank you.
What about the gas bill we had yesterday? You wanted to do something about that?